Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, Ward, this is not the kind of podcast we want to be doing.
It isn't.
It is a sad day for Indiana University fans. It is a sad day for Indiana Pacer fans. It is a sad day for anyone who ever came into contact with this gentleman, and a sad day for basketball fans everywhere, because we learned just a few hours ago the passing of the legend, George McGinnis.
We had the great privilege and honor of speaking both with Big George and with Slick Leonard, you know, who was his fellow legendary Hoosier and Pacer, and both of these gentlemen, and today with our mourning of the loss of George, you even have to think bigger than Indiana University, as hard as that is for us. But what both of these men meant to the game of basketball in the state of Indiana over their lifetimes and careers. And it's just so special that we did get to have these conversations. And, you know, in this one with George, where so many of us were not on the earth yet when he was in Bloomington, and to just get a peek inside to, you know, his experience, the growth he made, the impact he made in his couple of years in Bloomington, it's eternal. It will never not be one of the great experiences and players to take the court for the Indiana Hoosiers. It's just so sad that it's all in the past tense now, both his career and his life.
I remember just vividly my dad telling me about the great George McGinnis. And I remember it was about 20 years ago now that he started a phrase that he just has kept repeating for 20 years. And that was about 20 years or so ago is when a guy named LeBron James came onto the scene in basketball and was just lauded for his athletic ability, his prowess, the way he was built. He just looked different than everybody. And I remember just vividly my dad going, "Eric, George McGinnis was LeBron before LeBron. He was a man among boys." And my dad would just get filled with joy and passion talking about what it was like to watch George McGinnis play this game that he loved and that we all love and means so much to so many people. But McGinnis, even in that just 1 year at IU, you know, for my dad, it was like any talk of the greatest players at Indiana, McGinnis comes up because he was just head and shoulders above what anybody else was doing. And look, his stats prove it. I mean, the single biggest scoring season in the history of Indiana in his first year at IU, almost 15 rebounds a game and almost 30 points a game. It's staggering. By the way, I know that we'll play the intro, but one of the stats that just gets me the most is he's fifth all time at Indiana in 2010 games. He played one season. So it, I just, but my dad, just talking about the impact that this man made on him as a younger guy, just fills me with joy and pride thinking about him. And then if I could, you know, when we started this podcast and we started reaching out to these legends, and still happens, I'm nervous. I'm like, I don't have any shame, but I'm nervous in reaching out to them. And Big George was like the most nerve-wracking because Big George is his nickname, first of all. My dad had been filling me with this like man among boys forever. He just lived larger than life in my head and in the annals of basketball history, especially Indiana basketball history. And I got his number and I wasn't sure, do I call him? Do I text him? And I started texting him. And I didn't get a response right away. And then I remember where I was. I was in the front yard of Mandy's house when a text came through from Big George. Hi, Eric. Nice to meet you. Call me at this number anytime.
Mm.
And I couldn't get it fast enough. And I called him. And we had this great conversation. He was so sweet and so open and so gentle and so warm and enthused about doing this podcast and reliving that time at Indiana, because even though he played 1 year, he was there for 2 years,
right?
You know, because freshmen weren't allowed to play. And so he lived in Bloomington for 2 years. And obviously his career was at the end of one era and the beginning of before the beginning of the Bob Knight era. But he was genuinely enthusiastic to talk about the Hoosiers and what Indiana meant to him. And you and I talked about at the time that, like, Indiana did not do a good job of connecting Big George to fans and kind of, you know, owning a piece of Big George and his basketball legacy. They didn't do a good job with it, like, period. I actually think Mike Woodson has done a much better job with it, because Mike Woodson, coming from Indianapolis, you know, the legend of George McGinnis meant something very real to Mike Woodson. They had a long relationship. And there were pictures not all that long ago about Big George being in Bloomington with Coach, which was wonderful to see. So I give Coach Woody a lot of credit for that. But he was anxious and eager to reconnect that. And you and I were so happy when we got to talk to him. It's just one of those all-time memories that you and I will have. And when I think about this podcast and the people that we've been able to talk to, and now the people that are no longer with us, like you brought up Slick and mm-hmm. Big George, it makes me obviously incredibly sad, but also humble and joyous isn't the word, but really proud that we have this interview, this conversation that we were able to do with him and be able to share it again with our audience.
Absolutely. It's a conversation we had between ourselves when the news broke that there are three players on the state of Indiana Mount Rushmore of basketball players. And it's Larry Bird, Oscar Robertson, and Big George. And besides Larry's brief stint in Bloomington, which we all know was far too short, Big George is the only one of those three who was and forever will be an Indiana Hoosier. And that should fill us all with pride. And the fact that he was able to accomplish what he was pre-Coach Knight, post-Coach Branch McCracken, you know, he sadly fell in between two coaches that certainly could have brought a championship level team around him had they been there. But like, how great for your father and those other contemporaries that even in between two legendary Hall of Fame coaches, you have one of the greatest basketball players of all time, not just at the college level, but then went and did just spectacular things at the ABA and was such a big part of revolutionizing the game of basketball into really entertainment, just something that people came out, a whole city came out, a whole state got in support of. And really, you know, if you're enjoying Tyrese Halliburton playing right now, which you all should be, you have Big George, you have Slick to thank for that. And then, of course, George went on to play in the NBA and be spectacular there as well, even though it was a little bit later in his career. And, you know, we have become a more contemporary podcast. Just the natural evolution of the show as we've gotten to talk to so many of these guys already. But I don't for one second take for granted that we've been able to have these conversations. And, you know, long after this podcast is over, these will remain somewhere in the ether for generations to come who really want to appreciate and understand why Indiana basketball is special. They can listen to Big George talk about it for a while and know and understand from the guy.
My heart also goes out to Steve Downing. You know, Steve and Big George are inextricably linked. They played together. They were friends forever.
From high school, we should mention. We talk about it later.
Absolutely. They came to Indiana together from high school and decided to play for the Hoosiers and have stayed in touch all these years and extremely close. And we were lucky enough to have Steve on the show as well. So my heart goes out to him because I know what Big George meant to him. And again, we know what basketball means to people in Indiana. We know what Big George meant to people in Indiana. And it's a sad day for everybody. So the only appropriate tribute that we thought we could make is sharing that conversation that we had several years ago again with the audience. So hope you enjoy a little walk down memory lane with, the term is overused, but a true, in this case it's appropriate, a true legend.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, wow. This is as exciting as it gets for somebody who is a fan of Indiana basketball, not just at the college level, but at all levels. Eric, please let the people know what this gentleman has accomplished in his amazing basketball career.
Buckle in, everybody. Here we go. We are talking to a gentleman who was awarded Mr. Basketball in the state of Indiana in 1969 after winning a state championship. After that, he was also awarded Mr. Basketball in the entire country in 1969. He was first team All-Big Ten his one season at Indiana University, All-American in 1971. He has the highest scoring average in a season all time at Indiana at 29.9 points per game. We are going to ask him later on if he's upset that he didn't hit that 30.0, but we'll get to that later. He has the fourth best rebounding season average of all time at 14.7 rebounds. He has, this stat just blows me away. He is fifth all time at Indiana University in 20.10 rebound games. Fifth all time. He did it in one season. He is tied for number one all-time in a career at Indiana with 30.10 rebound games. Number one, one season. He is a three-time ABA All-Star. He is a three-time NBA All-Star. He is a two-time ABA champion. He is All-NBA First Team 1976. He is an NBA Hall of Famer inducted in 2017, one of only four Indiana Hoosier players to have that honor. He was the ABA playoffs MVP in 1975. He is simply put one of the greatest players to ever play the game of basketball. We are honored and privileged to speak to Big George McGinnis.
Welcome, George. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
So when you hear all of those accomplishments, when you just hear all those listed for you, which I'm sure you've heard at various times in your life, is there one that sticks out to you that you are just most proud of, or one that just brings a real smile to your face?
Well, yeah, I think for me, it's got to be the Indiana State High School Basketball Championship. You know, kids grow up here in our state playing basketball at a very early age where it's almost ingrained in us. And watching the state championship games as a young boy with my dad always inspired me to, you know, want to play the game. And I would always think you know, playing out in the backyard, you know, me playing in a state championship game and seeing the guys get that little gold ring that they got, that was one of the most satisfying feeling I think I've ever had in the game.
Well, let's get into that a little bit more. I did go back and watch your Hall of Fame induction speech, and you said there were two things that occurred in 1956 as a six-year-old boy that led you to love the game of basketball and embrace it. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. It was the first time that I got to read about Oscar Robertson all the time in the newspapers, the local newspapers, but never saw him. Didn't live too far away from him at the time. But seeing him win in 1956, that was one of the things that was so inspiring, not only for me, I think, but for every kid in that neighborhood that I lived in. And so it was the next day on a Sunday. We were all out in the backyard shooting hoops, you know, and that was a start for me. I was 6 years old.
And wow. And you were able to watch him play because your family had a television set now, right?
Yeah, we had an old raggedy television set where we had a, you know, we had to use a clothes hanger for an antenna, and you know, it kept going in and out. And my dad kept saying, "Keep changing." I missed part of the game just from changing the antenna around for the entire game. But it was a really, really good game, and it was so much fun to watch, and it really left a mark on me, and as well as a lot of other kids in my neighborhood.
When did you start playing basketball at the famous Meadowood Park?
I started playing there in high school. I was about 15 years old.
And what were those games like?
Oh, they were brutal. Brutal. You had one chance. If you won, you stayed out there. If you didn't, you might not play for another four or five games. So it was incredible. It brought guys from all over Central Indianapolis who played on, you know, on Saturday afternoons, and it was really competitive, a lot of fun. Ended up making a lot of friends, but boy, that was really a fun time. One of the most competitive, I would say, summer basketball that you could find was Meadowood Park back in those days.
Now, when did the fates allow you and Steve Downing to find each other as friends and teammates? Was it prior to high school, or was it once you guys got to school?
Right in the eighth grade, you know, I met Steve and then knew him slightly. We went to different middle schools. But we played Steve's school during the regular season that year, and then he was just a little guy. He was about 5'9" at that point in eighth grade, and he was 5'10" in Washington when he was a senior. I mean, was a freshman.
Wow.
And I was 6 foot, almost 6'5". So he grew almost a foot in high school. As a senior, he was 6'9". So he was a late bloomer, but he kept improving. And every time he'd come back to school the next year, he'd be a totally different person. I think, oh my God, I don't even know this guy. How many inches did he grow? But we become fast friends right away. We played all the time together, and I still talk to him at least once or twice a week to this day.
When did you know, George, that basketball was not just going to be something that you enjoyed playing, but something that could help get you, you know, to the next level, get you a scholarship in college and perhaps play professionally? When did that start to enter into your consciousness?
I think it was about my junior year. My coach, my high school coach, came to me and told me that that he had received a couple letters from colleges about a possible scholarship opportunity for me to play. And that's when it really, really hit. You know, I thought, you know, I've heard coaches told me when I was a sophomore, you know, you might be good enough to, you know, play in Division I college basketball. You just got to keep working hard. And then I start getting the letters, and that kind of certified things for me. And that was inspiring, you know. And then I end up with about 300 or 400 letters in all, because part of them were for football and part of them were for basketball. So
when you were growing up, obviously Oscar Robertson was somebody that you looked up to.
Right.
As far as Indiana University basketball players at the time, when you were a kid, the Van Arsdales were big players at Indiana University. Did they mean anything to you growing up?
Oh, absolutely. The Van Arsdales, Rick Mount. You know, I remember the Van Arsdales, I think it was in 63 that they played in the high school state championship game. And I remember them fouling out, and they end up losing the game. But the vision that I got locked in my mind was the crying, how disappointed they were that they had gotten beat. And I felt so bad for them. And years later, I got the opportunity to not only meet them, but play against them. And I can tell you, I don't think I've ever met two finer guys than the Van Arsdale twins. They are just unbelievable.
Now, you had mentioned high school coach getting scholarship offers. You actually had two great high school basketball coaches. Can you talk about Jerry Oliver and Bill Green and what made them so outstanding and how they influenced your approach to the game?
Well, Jerry Oliver was whom I, it was the first I played for at Washington. He brought me on to the varsity team as a freshman, gave me an opportunity, and you know, he kept encouraging me, but he was strong on fundamentals and dribbling with both hands and, you know, doing all kinds of different drills. A lot of working on just, you know, fundamental basketball, and really, really good coach. And he not only ended up going to, after my junior year, he left for IU and became an assistant coach down there. And I eventually ended up going there. And then after leaving IU, he became an assistant coach with the Pacers where I was. So he was a coach for me at every level.
I don't think it was a coincidence that Jerry Oliver ended up at Indiana University.
Yeah. I put in a couple good words for him for sure. And then Bill Green, who ended up taking over for Jerry after he left our junior year, he came in our senior year, and he's probably the most legendary, celebrated high school coach in Indiana basketball history. He won six state championships. The first one was with Washington, my high school. And he was just a guy who knew how to inspire. He knew how to get the best out of you by putting things in front of you. You know, one of the great things, and I can tell you, this is how bad things were for us in terms of not having money or access to anything. He told us one practice before the season started. He goes, "Yeah, I know you guys. We used to go to White Castle all the time. Every time we got a couple of bucks." White Castle is a little slow. They're called sliders here. I don't know if you guys probably know.
Oh, yeah. We know them well. We know them well.
Well, Bill Green, after the last practice before the season started, he goes, "I know you guys are always going to White Castle." So he says, "I'm going to make you a deal." He says, "If you, for every game you win, we'll go to White Castle, and each one of you can have 8 to 10 White Castles apiece." And we went 31-0. But he was really an inspiring coach. He had a legendary matchup zone defense that we played, and he went around and taught that to different colleges, Notre Dame, IU, and different other places. And then he went on to Marion High School in Marion, Indiana, and ended up winning 5 more championships there. So he was a great, great guy. He now has passed, but he left a very big mark on the high school game here in Indiana.
We have to ask, George, when was the last time you had a White Castle slider?
About a month ago.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't eat as many now, but every now and then you get a craving and you say, "Oh man, come on, I'll get a, you know, give me 4 or 5 of them," and just boom.
Ward and I were back in Indiana in February.
Brings back a lot of good memories.
Yes, Ward and I were back in Indiana in February. And we took different flights to get in, and Ward got in very late, like around midnight. And he called me. I was waiting for him at the hotel. And he said, "I just got to make one stop before I get to the hotel." Right. Stopped by White Castle and brought me some burgers, too.
There you go. Everybody here knows White Castle, man.
That's right.
They were a legendary place, yeah.
Well, can we get in a little bit to that magical senior season for you and Steve and Wayne Pack and Bill Green and your other teammates? First of all, just paint a picture for us what it was like a gym, your gym, let's say your gym at Washington, Friday night, a rival team comes to town,
right.
a good team, or comes across town, I should say. What was that atmosphere like? What was the passion, the excitement when it's still single class basketball at the high school level?
It was electric. You know, everyone went to high school basketball games back then, and every high school gym was packed on Friday and Saturday night. And everybody wore their team colors, and our team colors were purple and white. So everybody would come in the gym with a white sweater or a purple sweater. Bill Green wore a lot of purple sweaters as a coach. So, you know, it was so inspiring because, you know, you got the cheerleaders, you got the fans, it's loud. There, you know, we've got the largest high school gyms in the country here in Indiana. I think there's 8 of them. And we didn't have a big gym. We played a lot of our home games at Butler and Indiana Central College here, just because we didn't have enough room for the fans. So it was really inspiring. Just coming out to warm up, you know, you were just geeked up, you know.
In high school, George, who was the team that you liked to play against the most and beat?
Well, in Indianapolis, there were several teams, you know. It was very, very competitive. You had Attucks, where Oscar Robinson and I went to school. You had Tech High School, who ended up going to a state finals during that time. A lot of guys who ended up playing in the NBA during that era, too. And so there was 4 or 5 schools that were great competitors. I would say our biggest competitor was, during the time I was in high school, was Shortridge High School. They seemed to always give us the toughest time. We had the toughest time beating them. They beat us in our junior year by really just holding the basketball, slowing the basketball down, and end up it was a huge disappointment because we were favored to win that year as well. But they played an excellent ball game and beat us in a very tight, low-scoring game.
What did you learn from that loss that you took into the next year and helped shape you going forward as a competitor?
Well, I think, you know, we went in the locker room. I think it was a talk that we got from our coach, Jerry, who told us, you know, you're never too good to be beaten. And you know, we had played this team a couple of times during the regular season and had beat them thoroughly. And they came out and, you know, won that third game in the regionals. So it was, you know, always, you know, you always got to be prepared. You know, every game is important. It's just like the NCAA tournament. You know, there's no room for a bad game. You've got to be ready to play every single game. And that's the mindset we had coming into my senior year.
Well, your senior year, you go undefeated at 31-0, and like you said, that state championship still sticks out to you as the thing that you are most proud of. The other thing that was happening your senior year, I think you probably are aware of this, but Oscar Robertson was the all-time leading scorer in the state of Indiana high school basketball until you broke his record your senior year. Do you remember that? I mean, it is such a storied record to this day. Damon Bailey is now the all-time leading scorer and has been, you know, for over 20 years about 20 years now, right?
30 years.
What was that like for you to overtake your hero in that record?
Well, it was unbelievable because, you know, I always held him to the highest of esteem. He was kind of our hero. He grew up in our community. He was from my city. And, you know, I get to see him every few weeks or so on national television when they did broadcast the NBA game in those days, played for the Cincinnati Royals. But it was incredible. I got the ball, and it's over at my mom's house that was presented to me after the game. And it's one of my most prized possessions.
Oh, that's incredible.
Well, and you really sealed the deal there with your point total by recording 148 points in the last 4 games of that undefeated championship season to go on to win Mr. Basketball. What did it mean to you? You know, your parents moved up from Alabama in search of a better life for not only themselves, but of course, the next generation. What did that mean to not only win that, but then go on to represent the state as an Indiana All-Star?
Well, that was another high point in my high school career. Like I said, it meant everything to me. It meant that, you know, being Mr. Basketball, you represented not only Indiana, but your city, your state, your high school, your fans, your parents. It was all rolled into to one for me. So it was a great honor.
Now, there's a story that I heard in these classic Indiana-Kentucky All-Star games that happened after the season that I have heard told to me now from several people that were around then. But you play Kentucky in Indiana, and then you play them once in Kentucky. After the Indiana game, I heard there was some trash talking going on from the Kentucky players about you specifically. Do you remember this story?
Yeah, I do. Uh-huh.
Please tell us.
Well, there was a big rugged guy named Joe Voskiel. He was about 6'8", probably about 220. That's pretty good size for a high school kid, especially back in those days. And he guarded me, and, you know, he tried to be very physical. I thought I had an okay game. I think in the first game I had 21 points or something like that, 10 or 12 rebounds. We won the game, but then after the game, you know, he had made the comments, says, well, I've heard all this stuff about McGinnis. He doesn't seem to be that great to me. I've played pickup games with Oscar Robertson because he lived in that tri-state area of Cincinnati and Kentucky and all that. And he had said he had played some pickup games with Oscar. And there's nothing I can see that compares him to anybody that's really that good. So then the second game we played, the first game we played in Indianapolis at Butler University, and second game we played at the University of Louisville, I mean at Louisville Freedom Hall down there. And you know, it was ironic. That was the last game my dad saw me play. My dad was killed in a construction accident about 3 weeks after that Kentucky All-Star game. And I had 53 points and 31 rebounds.
Did you say anything to him afterwards, or did you look at him?
Not really, but he came over and said something to me, hugged me, and says, "Oh, man, I'm sorry. You know, this is what he says. I made a big mistake." I says, "No problem."
Wow.
Now,
and you know, the kid has called me several times over the years. He says, "Hey, George." He says, "Joe, you remember me?" I says, "I'll never forget you, Joe."
You did lose your father so shortly after that. How did that loss affect you, not only as a young man, but did you change the trajectory of the way you approach the game of basketball?
Well, you know, my dad was a real solid guy, man's man, you know. My mom was a great woman, and he wanted her to stay home and take care of the kids, which is what she'd done. He worked two jobs, and he worked in a factory at night, and he worked construction during the day. Well, he was working at a company called Eli Lilly, which is a very famous drug company, as we all know, and he was working on a project over there and fell off of a building, off of a scaffold, and killed himself. Mm-hmm. And he was killed from the accident. But it just put a whole new perspective on. I had never been around death. And it was my first time being associated with it. I never had any of my friends or friend family that died. I went to funerals for grandparents and things of that nature, but nothing so close. And my dad was only 42 years old, by the way. Mm-hmm. So it was a thought that how can I help my mom out? What can I do to make life better for her? So I did work in the summers, and then she started working, and you know, we made it through. And but it was tough. It was really tough.
Do you remember around that time when that happened, or in the wake of that, thinking to yourself, I have a chance to play professional basketball and make some decent money. I've got to get there as quickly as I possibly can?
Yeah, especially after my sophomore year, I knew that I was going to be leaving. Yeah, I thought, you know, that was the best way and the quickest way to make some money where I could make a serious impact on my mom's life. Yeah.
And not to jump ahead, but just a button on that. And what did you do with your initial signing bonus when you went professional?
I bought my mama's house, which mm-hmm. she still lived in, and she just died about 9 months ago. And she lived in that house for over 50 years. I mean, about 40 something years. And so she was very, very happy. And I was just so happy that I was able to help her, because she had done, her and my dad had done so much for me. It was just a way to say thank you and how much I loved her and appreciated everything for being such a good mother to me and my sister.
We talk a lot to former players, and we've talked to many coaches' sons or kids that grew up with their dad kind of pushing them into basketball or teaching them the game. And I think one of the most overlooked kind of support systems that exists here is how important the moms are in the shaping of basketball players and any athlete, really. Yeah. And clearly, your mom was a strong woman that helped you get to where you got.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, you go out throughout all the history of the NBA or even professional sports in particular, and especially the African-American players, one of the first things they do with their money is buy their mom a home. And it's almost a tradition now. And so it was really it really made me feel good, and my mom ended up having a really nice, comfortable life, and she lived to be 92 years old.
Wow. Now you did have to make a stop on the collegiate tour before you went to the professional ranks. Can you take us through the decision-making process to go to Indiana University along with Steve?
Well, you know, after Jerry Oliver left, or my coach at Washington for the first 3 years there, and he took the job at Indiana, me and Steve had pretty much decided, myself and Steve Downing, had pretty much decided we wanted to go to the same school. And we had talked the previous summer, and we talked about staying close to home. And we wanted to you know, we looked at a couple different schools, but IU was always our number one choice. So going into our senior year, we pretty much knew we were going to IU together.
You were recruited by Adolph Rupp at Kentucky, correct?
Yes, uh-huh.
And at that time in your basketball life, you know, Ward and I and our kids obviously hate Kentucky. We have to hate Kentucky, just part of being who we are. Did you have any feeling for Kentucky or the Purdue rivalry as you made your decision to go to Indiana in high school?
Well, yeah, I knew about the rivalry, but it wasn't ingrained in my head like seasoned veterans who had already been to college and experienced IU, Kentucky. You know, all I knew was a high school rivalry. I wasn't so ingrained in the college level rivalry. I did know that IU and Purdue had a big rivalry because they were interstate schools, but Kentucky, I knew that there was a rivalry, but it never hit me like that. But I was aware of it, but it didn't play a big role.
So just to set the stage here, this is a time in college basketball where freshmen were not eligible to play the varsity basketball. Right. You get to campus, you and Steve Downing. Indiana basketball was in a big slump.
Yes.
It had been many years since the Branch McCracken glory years. The Van Arsdales, who had some decent teams, are gone. And Indiana is really a bottom dweller in the Big Ten.
Right.
The joke that I have heard told to me many times is that the best team on campus your freshman year did not play collegiate basketball. And And what was it like for you that freshman year, knowing that you could help, but you weren't allowed to?
Yeah, it was really tough, confusing. And then, you know, you couldn't dunk a basketball back then either.
Right.
So that whole process of all the new rules that had come into the game seemed like it just short-sighted us, being big guys and everything. It hurt us. And it was because of a guy named Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He was so dominant that they changed the rules because of him. So, you know, we played intramural ball back in those days, and we got a little freshman team, and, you know, we played against some different kids from around the campus. But we did get to play the varsity team one time, and we beat them pretty well.
Was it something where you were frustrated, but it somehow was an opportunity to really hone your game? Were you able to even be around any of the coaches to help develop, or was it all on you while you were waiting to come into the program?
It was pretty much you were on your own. You know, we had, I think I went to all the games, but that was it. I never went to any of the practices. We just played around the campus. So, and then every now and then when the gym was open, they would let us sneak in there and shoot. But, there was a lot of restrictions on freshmen back in those days. So it was pretty frustrating where you've been playing ever since, 7, 8 years old, and all of a sudden you got to take a year off.
How much fun was it just to be on that beautiful campus with all those wonderful, fun-loving people around you?
Oh, man, it was the greatest 2 years of my life. I don't think that I could ever ask for anything else that I had more fun and enjoyed so much. It's an incredibly beautiful campus with all the limestone buildings and going up and down the hills and walking to class and meeting different people from all over the state and all over the country as well. And it was a great experience for me.
So your freshman year ends. There is a buzz on campus, and I can speak once removed about this because my father was there at the time, and he has told me, along with many other people, like great IU historian Bill Murphy, who I believe you know as well, that there was an excitement because of you and Steve Downing, but there was a real thought that this could really be the class that gets Indiana back. Clearly, Lou Watson thought the same thing. And now your sophomore year starts. What do you remember about just finally, after a year off, being able to play in those first couple games?
Well, it was incredible. We played in the old field house back in those days, and they were just starting to build Assembly Hall my freshman year, and so it was exciting. It was. You got that place packed and, all the red and white, the IU song and the theme song of the college. It was really, really exciting. It was now, boy, I'm back in my element again. This is why I came here,
Well, the third game of the year, you are welcomed into that rivalry we touched on when number 5 Kentucky comes to town.
Right.
And again, you are coming out of several years of really poor performance from the Indiana basketball team, but you guys are giving them all they can handle. The game is tied. Right. It feels like this is kind of the coming out party for this new era of Indiana basketball. You take them to the end of the game. It's a tie game with just seconds left. Do you remember what happens at the end of regulation?
I have never, ever been able to get this out of my mind. Yeah, we got a rebound, and the score was tied. And John Ritter was passed the ball, and there was a few seconds left on the clock. And I thought I saw Luke signal for a timeout, and he didn't. And I called timeout, and he just slung up a 70-footer, and it was all net. And boy, my heart sunk. So we end up losing the game, and it took me a long time to get over that. A long time, but yeah, it's one of the great stories that's told about IU basketball to this day.
And just to make sure everybody gets it, so he flings it, but at the same time, on another part of the court, you thought the coach was asking for a timeout, so you called a timeout, basically simultaneously.
Yes.
And then and then your stomach just has to drop when you see that ball go through the hoop.
Oh, my. Yeah. And then as I walked to the bench, now the whole coaching staff and all the teammates are looking at me like, what are you doing? And then it finally hit me, and Lou says, I didn't call timeout. And I just thought, he says, we don't want him to set up. He says, why'd you do that? I says, I thought I saw you call a timeout. But it was one of the great disappointments especially early in my career, third game, and you have that happen. I felt like I cost my team the game, you know.
Well, you scored 38 points and 20 rebounds in that game, and clearly are the reason that the team won many games, including the next game against number 7 Notre Dame, where you go to Notre Dame and you win that game, which sets off a win streak of 3 in a row. So things do seem to be turning around. The Big Ten season starts. Northwestern was your first Big Ten game. You go off for 38 points and 23 rebounds. I mean, just saying these numbers, George, for us, it just sounds like we're talking about a video game here. I mean, it's incredible. You had to be excited here that, like, things were really turning around for Indiana.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We were on the upswing, and, you know, there was a lot of interest. You know, a lot of people were interested in Indiana basketball again. We were filling up the arena, and a lot of excitement. Yeah, so everyone felt good at that time.
So now you're starting to travel some, and from what I understand, there, you know, wasn't a lot of that in your high school career. What's it like going to, you know, the other Big Ten schools, Minnesota, Ohio State? You know, this is going to be your life for a long time to come. What was it like to be a traveling basketball stud?
It was incredible. You know, we had a prop plane that Indiana had at the time that we flew to games, to see the different campuses. And it was always in the winter time, like Michigan. It was the coldest place I think I was at in the whole time. Wisconsin, I thought, was one of the most beautiful campuses I had ever been to or seen in the Big Ten. And so we got to experience a lot of Michigan State was good. And it was just a great experience being able to travel. Ohio State was incredible. That was an incredible school. So, yeah, it was great. Not only now, we're not playing just in Indiana. We're playing, you know, all across the Midwest and parts of the United States, you know.
And what does that traveling do for a team to bond you guys and bring you closer together?
Well, it's a time for, you know, you can sit and strategize about the team you're going to play. You can just have fun talking on the plane. Most guys are, you know, listening to it, you know, something on their little radio or something like that. So coach is giving out stuff that we can look at about the other team. It's a great bonding time.
So the season goes on for a while. You take back then there was a bit of a semester break for finals. You come back for one kind of tune-up game before getting back into the Big Ten season. That tune-up game ends up being a memorable one because you score your Indiana and career high in college. You go off for 45 points and 20 rebounds against Northern Illinois.
Right.
And then you play Purdue in a tough game where you lose, but that sets off a win streak where you win 6 in a row. And and you really set yourself up for to really have a chance at winning the conference. And back then, you had to win the conference to get to the NCAA tournament.
Right.
So it feels, heading into your last 4 games, I believe you're a game out of the Big Ten lead. And then things really start to falter, and IU loses 3 of 4. But the other interesting thing that's happening that I'd love your perspective on is there really becomes this anti-Lou Watson sentiment from the fan base. It becomes a fairly toxic time for Lou. And then there is this classic story of after you guys actually beat Iowa in your one win of the last 4 games, several players from the team sit down with Dr. John Brown, a professor at IU, to really go to him and say, things aren't working with Lou. What do you remember about that time and what was happening on the team?
Well, you know, Lou had recruited a lot of all-star type players. Some of them didn't get to play as much as they thought they wanted to. And there was a group that just kind of turned on him. Lou wasn't one of the all-time great coaches that we've ever seen, but he was a really good guy. He knew the game very, very well. He played for, the old coach there at IU.
Branch McCracken, yeah.
And he loved Branch, and so he brought a lot of the Branch philosophy with him during his time at IU. I truly enjoyed playing for him. But there were several guys who, you know, did not like him. And during that period, there was a lot of protesting. You know, that was the, remember the Olympics with the Tommy, what's his name? You know, that's the classic poster.
Oh, sure. Black. The track star.
Yeah.
Yes. And then during that same year, the Indiana football team had a problem. And all the black players on that team protested about some issues and problems that they were having. And this, I don't know if this was a carryover with that or what, but it was something I didn't agree with. I didn't, because I was playing, obviously, but
right.
There was a lot of guys felt like, you know, Lou just wasn't getting the job done. And that also played a big role in me saying, okay, I don't need any more of this. I'll just turn pro.
Right.
Well, to reflect on this season, which one could be argued was the single greatest individual season that ever occurred at Indiana University, did you just feel in dominating opponents that way that it was something where the professional ranks, you know, were obviously a given that you were going to go there, but did you already understand at that level how well you could do it the next, or was there still a little anxiety about how well you would do going against grown men getting paid for the game?
Well, at that point, I pretty well knew that I had the ability to play at that level. I don't know if I ever thought I had the ability to be at the same level I was in high school and college, because now, you know, every level, the competition gets better, and there's guys not only as good as you, but better than you as you move up. So I did, you know, being here in Indianapolis, I got to meet several of the Pacers. And my senior year in high school, several of them came to the game, to my high school game, several of them. And it's Freddie Lewis, who was one of the all-time great guards in the ABA. He says, man, you could play for our team right now. You could help us right now. That started putting thoughts in my head. You know what I mean? So I knew I could contribute, but I didn't know how effective. I knew I could do something, but I didn't know how effective I could be.
So just to put a button on your Indiana career, and something that I think we've mentioned before on this podcast, but it doesn't get enough attention because of the way it ended with Lou. No one says a bad word about Lou. They may not have liked playing for him, but everybody says what you said. He was a classy guy.
One of the all-time great guys. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say the way he left. So all of this pressure comes to him. He actually steps aside. Jerry Oliver right. coaches the last game of the season. But the right. most amazing thing about Lou Watson is, of course, Bob Knight is then brought in. Lou right. Watson remains on staff of the athletic department, and he and Coach Knight actually become very friendly. Coach Watson, right. despite being kind of moved off the team against his own wishes, loves Indiana so much that does whatever he can to help smooth the transition to the next coach. I think that just speaks to the class of this man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the kind of guy he was. And I think he ended up working for another 30 to 35 years for the university.
Yes.
Different capacities. So, you know, I always see him at golf outings or, you know, different functions for the school that I would attend. But yeah, he was an IU guy. He bled blue and he bled red and white, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's great.
So destiny calls and it's time to pursue your professional dreams. Can you talk us through how you found yourself going back home to play for your hometown Indiana Pacers?
Well, again, you know, I'm in a unique position. Back in those days, an ABA team, if there was a guy in your area, you could go and get him. You got a right, kind of a right of first refusal.
Territorial rights, right?
Right, exactly. But in the NBA, the Philadelphia 76ers had drafted me once I announced that I was coming out of school. So in those days, they held your rights for a lifetime. Meaning that if you were going to play for a team, it was only going to be Philadelphia in the NBA. So, and then you know, I got to talk with several of the players from the Pacers. They had just come off a championship season, their first one. there was a buzz in Indianapolis about what they've accomplished. And so I met with the coach and the general manager, and they expressed an interest in having me, and that solidified everything in terms of making my decision.
It's really interesting here because obviously you go to the ABA, you go to the Pacers, and you win back-to-back championships. You are playing at just an incredible level. Your last year with the Pacers, you also, your first stint with the Pacers, you get to the finals. But what I really want to focus on is, you know, my dad, from the time I remember being a conscious human being, would tell me about the great big George McGinnis. And when I got really excited as a basketball fan to watch Michael Jordan play, but then when LeBron came on the scene and I got real excited about LeBron, my dad would say, let me tell you something. There was a LeBron before LeBron. His name was George McGinnis. He was a man amongst boys. And we've heard several people, including Steve Downing, tell us about how great you were on the court, and the stats back that up. But there's another LeBron comparison that's really interesting to me, which is LeBron really is looked at as the poster child for taking on the power of the player and really shifting the balance of power in the NBA from owners and one-sided contracts to players really taking ownership of where they want to play, mobility amongst teams. You really were 30 years ahead of your game here, maybe 40 years ahead of your time, when you sued the NBA and its 18 teams because of this lifetime rights that the Sixers claimed on you. Is that correct?
Right. Correct.
So can you just walk us through that, George, on what the thinking was back then and what were you hoping to accomplish?
Well, certainly I thought it was totally unfair that someone could draft you and then just hold your rights for your entire lifetime of, you know, whatever, you know, if, let's say if I'm 40 years old and I want to join a team in the NBA just to, you know, be a 2-minute player, then I had to play with a certain team. It just seemed like it wasn't fair. And we got together, my agent and a few attorneys, and I ended up signing with the Knicks after I left Indiana. I didn't sign with the Philadelphia 76ers. And I knew I didn't, you know, we didn't make the kind of money that, you know, players make today. And I didn't have enough money to defend this case. So the New York Knicks indemnified me. And they're the ones who put up the money to fight that case, and they end up losing.
Yeah, they were no fools. They didn't want you going to Philly.
Right.
Let's go back to the Pacers, because this is really an incredible run you have with them, both with what you're doing individually and what you guys are doing as a team. And that had actually started before you got there. Can you tell us what it was like to play for fellow Hoosier legend, a former IU national champ point guard, Slick Leonard?
Oh, he was great. And it's another Branch McCracken disciple, you know, just like Lou Watson had some of the same philosophies. He was a really, really good playoff coach. In pressure games, he knew how to change strategies, change offenses. He could flip-flop guys around. Good, really good at that type of thing. And he got along very well with the players. Guys would run through a wall for him. As I said, they had won a championship the year before I got there. So, you know, I was just kind of walking softly when I first came in there, and had a pretty good rookie year. But yeah, it was a lot of fun because it was coming from IU, where you had all the turmoil with the guys my sophomore year, to going to a team where, you know, everybody did everything together. You know, we rode horses. You know, we went out shooting guns. We did this. We did that. It was all together. So I just loved that whole concept of unity back then.
And he really became more to you than just a coach, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Like a second father. Yeah.
Well, I like that you said you really you know, walked softly. Your walking softly turned into 4 years averaging 25.2 points and 12.9 rebounds a game your first 4 years in the ABA. I'm just curious because we love hearing the stories. In the ABA those first 4 years, who was the best player you played against?
Oh, without question, Julius Erving, but there were so many others. George Gervin, Artis Gilmore, Rick Berry, who came to our league. You know, there was great players everywhere, you know. I think the guy who probably was a flagship guy of the league was Julius. And, you know, and it was very competitive. You played the same team over and over and over and over again, so you got to know him pretty well, you know.
Sure.
But it was a lot of fun. And there was something about the ABA that even though you played against these different teams, there was a camaraderie that we had because, you know, we were kind of the stepchild to the NBA, and no one really ever thought that this league had the best players. And in actuality, when we merged, we found that out the first couple of years of the All-Star game, most of those players were ABA guys.
Now, can you talk a little bit more about that dynamic of the ABA being the stepbrothers? It really allowed for a flourishment of personality and individual style, you know, both in the way, you know, played and you know, 3-point shot and all that kind of great stuff. Can you talk to us about what made the ABA so fun, not only to play for, but to watch as a fan?
Well, yeah, you know, I watched some of the old football shows. I was watching one the other night, the old Baltimore Colts. There was a guy named Art Donovan.
Oh, sure.
Probably one of the all-time funniest ex-athletes ever. Now, he's no longer living, but boy, he was a great storyteller. And, you know, our coach, Bobby Leonard, he told great stories. And then, he could do certain things. Yeah, we're playing in a game in against Denver. Larry Brown was the coach at that time, and this was a brutal series that we played. This was my fourth year, maybe my third year, because I won two championships my first 2 years, and then all of our veterans had left, and we were kind of in a rebuilding mode, but we ended up getting back to the finals that year. But we played Denver in Western Conference final. And the seventh game was out there. And, you know, it was a tight game throughout the entire game. And maybe this was a sixth game, I'm sorry. But anyway, he calls a play for me to kind of, they were going to get the ball in, reverse the ball on the other side of the floor. I was going to get a pick underneath the bucket, come around, try and get the ball, take it up, either get fouled or try and score. Well, during the process of the play broke down. We did get the ball in. We had a kid named Billy Keller who went to Purdue, played with Rick Mount, who was a tremendous shooter, and he played at the same high school I did and won a 1965 state championship team at Washington High School, which was another inspiration for us in 69. But anyway, you know, with the seconds running down, you know, I say, Billy's open. I tell this kid, Kevin Joyce, who's got the ball. He throws it to Billy Keller in the corner, and he hits a 3-point shot, and we win that game. Now, on the way to the locker room, we're all jumping and screaming, hollering. You know, we beat them. Now we're going to the finals of the ABA again, and we're going to play Kentucky. And we get to the locker room, and all these reporters come in, and, you know, our coach, Leonard, is sitting there. And a guy, I heard a reporter ask him, he says, well, coach, how could you make a call like that in a tie ball game, and a kid takes a 3-point shot? You know, he says, that's just inconceivable to me. And Slip looks at the reporter and says, well, son, if you're going to be a coach in this league, you got to make decisions. And it was the biggest broken play. He never called a player. It was old type of characters. You know, we had all kind of characters, Marvin Barnes, and, you know, we had the Afros and the bell bottoms, and, you know, it was just an incredible league. A lot of characters, a lot of good guys, though.
Now, you did pretty well in that playoff run. You nearly averaged a triple-double at 32 points, 16 rebounds, 8 assists in those 18 games. Just one of the great playoff runs ever. But I do want to ask, when did your signature one-handed jump shot develop? Was that earlier, you know, high school, college, or when did that really become your go-to weapon?
You know, like I said, my idol was Oscar, and he always put the ball back behind his head when he shot. And I started doing that, and I had these big hands, and that's the way it developed. It was an awful shot. I don't think any of my coach ever liked me shooting. But it was just a bad habit that I picked up that I could not get out of. It was hard for me to put two hands on the basketball.
Maybe you couldn't get out of that habit because the shot kept going in.
Yeah, the results work.
It was working for me there, yeah.
So we went over what happened then with the Knicks and then kind of forcing the hand of the 76ers, which ended up being great leverage for you,
right,
where you signed a six-year, no cut, no trade, no option contract for $3.2 million with the Philadelphia 76ers after 4 years of playing with the Pacers. Now, I know I say 6 years, $3.2 million in 2020, and people think, oh, that's not that big of a deal. But that was a huge contract when you signed it.
It was a huge contract, one of the biggest in professional basketball. But
What did that feel like, George? I mean, you struggled financially, your family struggled, your father passed away, made things harder for your family and your mom. And now this is really, you know, we're talking in mid-70s. This is kind of generational wealth at this point. This sets up your whole family. Just tell us what that was like for you.
Well, it was incredible. I just thought, man, I just can't. I'm just thinking about where I come from, you know, this whole process of, you know, high school, my little neighborhood, and then IU and the Pacers, and, you know, I end up at this spot. I just felt like one of the most fortunate guys in the world, you know, and very blessed.
I have to ask, we know when with your signing bonus money that you originally got, you bought your mom a house, but now you get this big contract, one of the biggest that's ever been signed. Did you buy yourself anything silly?
I bought I think I had three or four cars, but I never went crazy. I never went really crazy.
What was that first car though that you bought?
It was an XKE Jaguar.
Oh, nice. What year was it? Brand new.
Yeah, it was a 1973, and you know, I wish I had that car today because it would have been worth a lot of money.
No kidding.
My dad has a 67 that he still has, and it's his pride and joy.
Man. They're the most beautiful car. I mean, I love driving that car. But I drove a Cadillac back in those days, and then I drove a truck. For most of my career, I drove a truck.
So you get to Philly, and they were bottom dwellers before you got there. You, in your first season, you're all NBA first team. You turn them into instant contenders. But really, to get to the next level, a guy shows up the next season who you seem to think pretty highly of, this Dr. J fellow. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to now be his teammate as opposed to his opponent?
Well, you know, we had had a really good year. The first year I got there, made the playoffs, and you know, we brought the fan base back. There was a little bit of excitement in the air in Philadelphia about the team. And then all of a sudden, I had the coach and general manager come to me and says, "Hey, we got a chance to sign Julius Erving. What do you think?" I said, "You go get him right now." So that's what happened, and so we end up having some really good years, and things kind of fell off. But yeah, we went to the finals. It was incredible. You know, the thing about Julius is that, you know, I knew how good he was because we got to play against him about six times during the year in the old ABA, because there were so few teams that you played against a team a lot of times. So I knew how great he was, but to play with him for a full season, almost every game you saw something that I had never seen before done on a basketball court. He was an amazing guy. Amazing.
What was, is there a play? I'm sure there are many, but one that sticks out that you just caught yourself on the court being.
They do a lot of alley-oop passes now. You see these great alley-oop passes, and I think it was Duck Collins threw him a pass. It looked like it was almost going out of bounds, and he jumped up and grabbed it with one hand and almost brought it back around the backboard and dunked it. It was like, you know, I'd never seen anything like that. And it was almost something like that every game. You would see something that he would do that would say, oh, my God, did you see that? It's crazy.
George, when you think back on your career in the NBA and ABA, is there a play that you made that sticks out as like almost surprising yourself or just one that makes you incredibly happy, one singular play?
Yeah, I think so. Our second year, we're playing in the ABA finals against Kentucky, Dan Issel and Gilmore, and they had a really, really good team. I'm trying to think of a little guard's name. He was in the Hall of Fame. He went in before I went in. Louis Dampier,
Okay.
Who was a really fine player. But anyway, we're in the fifth game down in Kentucky. And again, it's a really, really close ball game. And Slick calls a play for me. And I botched a play and lose the ball out of bounds. I mean, just had it in my hands. Here I go up for a little lay-in and just come out of my hands. So we call a timeout, or Kentucky calls a timeout. And so, you know, we're just going to play straight man-up defense and, you know, not foul and, you know, try and challenge a shot without fouling. So I saw this play. They took it out, the ball out at half court, and I saw this play develop, and it's just weird. I just could see it, that everybody lined up at the half court line, and four guys broke, the Kentucky guys broke toward their bucket. And the guy I was guarding kind of went in the backcourt to receive the ball. I could almost visualize this play before it happened. I said, I know they're not going to do this. And they did it, and I intercepted the ball and went in and scored, and we won the game. So
That
is the biggest play I've ever made.
I'm curious, George, so after you signed this 6-year, no-cut, no-trade contract, you play a few years with Philadelphia, and then you are traded to the Nuggets. Did they have to come get your permission for that?
Oh, yeah, I had to give them permission, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And what was it about that? Was your time just done in Philadelphia and you were ready for a change?
They were ready for a change. We had went to a finals. We had a great year. Then we went to the finals. Then we got beat in the first or second round the next year. And they just wanted to bring in some new players. And it really was, ended up being a good move for Philly because they ended up winning a championship with that team.
Right.
But they were surrounded with some really good players, Andrew Toney and – you know, Moses Malone and people like that. We had more younger guys, Daryl Dawkins and who was really, really good, but they were young. But they came to me and I approved the trade. Yeah.
Well, and you transitioned very well. You go to Denver and you become an all-star there too. So obviously The altitude didn't affect you negatively, but sadly, shortly thereafter, you blow out your Achilles. How long did it take you to, and obviously sports medicine was nowhere near then where it is now. How long did it take for you to accept that you weren't going to be the same player you were, and how did you adapt to that?
You almost never accept it. You know, in your mind, you think you can always come back. It was a couple, 3 years after I had left the game that I finally said, you know what, it was time for you to go. You know, you always think that, okay, I'm going to, you know, I'll rehab this, I'll get better. But I was never the same after that injury. So my game obviously went downhill. My time as a player in terms of playing minutes went way down. I became a second-tier player. So, yeah, it was hard to take. You know, I had a life of, you know, just playing this game that I love so much. From the time I was a little kid, now all of a sudden it's over. But, you know, fortunately for me, like I said, I was brought up with great parenting, two parents that taught me a lot, and my post life has almost been better for me than my playing life. It's been great.
Well, I want to get into that, but just to put a button on your professional playing career, this does not often get a chance to happen, but your hometown team trades for you, and you're right. Able to finish your career back in Indianapolis, back with the Pacers, where it kind of all started for you as a professional athlete. And I just know how happy it must have made every fan that went to that game to be able to watch you one more time. No matter if you weren't the player you were still Big George McGinnis. And as you know, everybody, when they look at you, remembers that Washington State Championship team. They remember your year at Indiana. They remember those ABA championships. So it must have been a nice kind of bittersweet thing to end your career where it started.
Oh, absolutely. That was the greatest thing, is that I was able to end my career right here in Indiana. And I've always been very well treated by the fans of the game here in Indiana. And I was treated well when I came back. And in post career, I was treated well as well. So yeah, it was a real treat to be able to retire right here in Indiana.
Now, George, we know in 49 states it's basketball; it's just a game. Right. It's so much more than that in the state of Indiana, and there's been so many great players come through Indiana in the last century plus. But you're the one that won it all in high school. You went and played for the most storied college program in the state, and then you brought championships to the state with the Pacers. I think there's really no argument to be made that any single basketball player in the history of the state of Indiana should be more embraced, celebrated, or identified as the single best Indiana basketball player who played and represented the state at all three levels. Are you ever just driving in the car or sitting at home and just realizing, man, I'm the one guy in the whole history who got to do it at all three levels at the highest level and make my state so proud?
Well, yeah, and I think that the crowning factor was to be able to play at all three levels in this state and accomplish all that. So, you know, I knew that Oscar was he was a guy who set the tone, but he never played here. He played in Cincinnati and in college and in the pro level. But I was embraced from high school, college, and pro right here in Indiana. And I still think to this day that it's one of the great blessings that I ever had. I see guys all the time who's 75, 80 years old, and they'll say, "Oh, I remember you in '69. I was sitting under the balcony in the state championship game." That happened. So it's really great, man. It's been a real blessing.
And your post-playing career, George, obviously you've been kind of married with the Pacers for a long time as well. But just kind of what has been the highlight for you in the almost 40 years since wrapping up your playing career?
Well, you know, I think family first. You know, I was married to my high school sweetheart, and unfortunately, I lost her last year. She caught cancer. And we were together for 42 years, and that was so amazing. I knew her. We went to the same elementary school together, same junior high, same high school. So just going through that whole experience, my family background, the kids on my high school team, we get together about every other week, and right around the corner from Washington High School, a place that's been there for over 100 years, called Working Man's Friend. And they've got great hamburgers. We meet and have hamburgers every 2 weeks. So
that's great.
About five or the six of the guys on my high school team, we still get together. So that's always a lot of fun.
Is Steve Downing part of that group?
Absolutely. Steve Downing, Wayne Pack. Jim Arnold. And a few of the reserves, four starters. The other starter, Louis Day, who unfortunately died here a few years ago. But yeah, just about six guys who show up every other week.
Now, as an Indiana kid growing up in the 80s and 90s as a Pacers fan, I did not get to enjoy your glory days there. But for me, of course, there was a pretty good player there named Reggie Miller. Can you talk about what he means to you and to that franchise?
He was incredible. You know, folks in Indiana love guys who can really shoot the basketball. Rick Mount, Damon Bailey, you know, you just go throughout the years. All these guys were great scorers. And I remember the day Reggie was drafted, you know, they were booing the Pacers because everyone here wanted the Pacers to draft Steve Alford, who was a great high school and college player here. And, you know, Reggie, you know, I think he felt like he had a lot to prove, but boy, did he win the fans over. He done more for the NBA Pacers than any other player that ever played here. He was just tremendous. He was a great guy. He did a lot of stuff in the community. He is beloved here.
And then you have Slick Leonard yelling "Boom, baby!" every time he knocks one down. You just had to feel like it was one big happy family as all that was going on.
Right. I told Slick, I says, "Man, you're the only guy I've ever known could make a life out of just "Boom, baby," you know.
And George, besides the every couple weeks hamburger lunch or dinner that you get together for, what's keeping you busy these days?
Well, I've had a company I've had for 28 years that we do a lot of work with big manufacturers, Toyota, Cummins Engine, people like that. In different sectors of manufacturing. That's been a lot of fun and interesting. So I've done a lot of stuff for the Pacers, appearances. I worked for the lottery here for a while. I was a spokesperson for about 10 years. I did some Butler games, which was very rewarding. I was able to even broadcast about 7 or 8 state high school championship games.
Wow, that's awesome.
That was the epitome of it all. And, you know, because you see not only the side where the team wins, but you also see the side where the team loses, and you feel so bad for the kids. But, yeah, I've had a really good life, man. I've been blessed.
Now, there's another pretty good Indiana basketball Indiana University Hoosier basketball player who's on the Pacers these days. Obviously, the season has been postponed. We'll see what's going to happen with that. But is there a connection with somebody like Victor Oladipo who, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he suffered a pretty severe injury, and he was just coming around, getting back to the old Victor right before we had this little issue, the coronavirus. But he is an absolute great person. The fans love him. He's enthusiastic. He's one of those guys who are always reaching out in the community to do something. So I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. And he was real. I loved him at Indiana University. And I think his first 2 or 3 teams that he played for in the NBA didn't appreciate what they had. And I think the Pacers saw something in him that other teams didn't see. And it was almost unleashing that energy that he had when he got here. And he has been an absolute joy to watch play.
One question I got to ask you before we let you go here. When you did leave Indiana after your sophomore year and they hired Coach Knight, there is some rumors out there that you left because Coach Knight came in and said, there's going to be no stars on this team. Did you have any relationship with Coach Knight? Is that just urban legend?
No, I never ever met him or talked to him. You know, I was 19. He was just a 29-year-old young guy that was at Army. No one had ever heard of him.
Right.
And no, we never had a conversation. And, yeah, after I got done playing with the Pacers, after they brought me back, Steve Downing got us together. And we had an incredibly long, good relationship. And he always refers to the fact that in 19, I think it was 74 that they played UCLA in the semifinal
73,
game.
73 in the final four, yeah.
He says, "Boy, if we'd had you here, I think we'd have won that, George." I says, "You don't realize how I sit there. We were on the road playing in the NBA and watching that game. I was in the ABA actually watching that game and just thinking, boy, I wish I was on that team because they gave UCLA all they wanted." And I became good friends with Coach Knight over the years. So
that's beautiful. I mean, there is nothing – you talk about how the fans in the state – love good shooting. That is absolutely true. But the other thing we love is to know that Indiana basketball is a family and that that the people are connected, like you playing for Slick Leonard and you and Steve Downing still friends and some connection to Coach Knight and Victor. That just kind of, it's what separates Indiana basketball from any other place in the world.
Right. I get asked all the time when I was playing in the league, he says, what's so great about playing here in Indiana? I says, you know what? You wouldn't get it. You know, you're from Jersey, or, you know, you're from this place or that place. I says, just something special about the game. You know, when I went into the Hall of Fame in 2017, I got a lot of different things that I read about Indiana basketball. You know, it was started in Massachusetts with a peach basket, but the first rim with nets come right here from Indiana, Crawfordsville, Indiana. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So we played a big role in this whole explosion of this game of basketball. We played a big role in it. So. Yeah, and I think it's carried over. You know, 1954, a kid hit a shot they said was heard around the world. And it inspired a sports movie called Hoosiers, which I think is one of the great movies that's ever been made.
Absolutely, best sports movie ever.
Yeah, and that's kind of started this crazy love of high school basketball and college basketball here in Indiana. You know, once you're an Indiana fan, you're always an Indiana fan. So whether I'm there or I'm looking at it on my couch, I'm always rooting for the Hoosiers.
Well, George, you know that means so much to all Hoosiers to know you're there in spirit and watching what's going on the court.
George, I cannot wait to finish this with you and call my dad and tell him that I got to talk to the legend, Big George McGinnis. It has been an honor and a pleasure. We have heard stories about you since we were little kids, and you are as classy and as much of a gentleman as everybody says you were, and we just cannot thank you enough for what you've given the game of basketball, what you've given the state of Indiana.
Thank you much, guys.
Just wow.
Yeah, re-listening to it, again, I'm just like giddy that we got to talk to this legend and share his story with our fans and with Indiana basketball fans. And when I say Indiana basketball fans, I am saying Indiana as the big Indiana, the entire state, because obviously his fandom extends way beyond Hoosiers. So hope you enjoyed that. George,
I will say, the magic of Indiana, of Bloomington, that you think somebody who went on to such incredible career success, becoming one of the true all-time greats of the sport, that IU continued to hold such a special place in his heart. And to your point in the intro of Coach Woodson getting him back down there and making sure, you know, he knows that he will forever be a Hoosier and thought of as not just a great basketball player, but with a lot of the outpouring you see of people who knew him or just met him, of just as every bit as big as his body was his heart, and that warmth of which you spoke, that he spoke with you on the phone initially, is clearly one of the great gifts he gave to the state, to the city of Indianapolis, and of course in his time in Bloomington. Just a wonderful human being above and beyond a magical basketball player.
Heart goes out to his family and his friends and the people that knew him best. He is an Indiana legend. Rest in peace, Big George McGinnis.